Welcome back to the National Defense. It's Randy Miller. And, man, I seem like, to me, I'm visiting with an old friend now. Band leader extraordinaire, the guy that does it all, Paul Shaffer, is with us here in the National Defense. Paul, how are you?
Randy, I'm great, and it's great to be with you here.
Man, it's so great to see you. You know, I mean, obviously, huge fan from not just the Letterman show, but everything that you've done. And I'm watching YouTube last night, and I see you interviewing Donald Fagen from Steely Dan.
Right. I guess that was, you know, I did a series for Axis Television where I interviewed rock performers mostly, and then we played together too. I would have two, you know, in his case, right. We had two keyboards. We were playing, and he was telling stories. I guess he doesn't do too much stuff like that, so it was an honor to have him on my show. He wouldn't sing, though. I said, you know what, I'm not going to sing.
Yeah.
He said, I need 15 guys before I feel comfortable. So I said, well, I'll sing your stuff. So I had to sing all his hits. But anyway, I'm glad you saw it.
You're a great interviewer.
Thank you. Well, you know, I watched the best guy, David Letterman. I watched him do it every night for 33 years.
But you do it so differently.
You've got to pick up something.
Yeah, you do it so differently, and it's almost kind of a rapid fire. I was mesmerized by your interview style. It's so good, and I would encourage people to go to YouTube and find some of these great interviews because, things about Donald Fagen I never knew, you guys have been friends for quite a while, right?
Well, you know, it was also funny. He knows that I'm friendly with Chevy Chase still.
From, sure.
You know, our friendship started in 1975, the first season of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And Fagen just wanted to talk about comedy, it seemed.
Yeah.
Because he knew Chevy. He had gone to college with Chevy. And this was absolutely true that Chevy was a drummer. He and Walter Becker in Bard College had a rock band. Chevy was a drummer. And Fagen said, Chevy was a good drummer. I said, oh, you know, stop the press. I couldn't believe that he had said Chevy could actually play drums, apparently, which I didn't realize before. Anyway, he was talking about comedy and how they all worked for a guy named Ken Shapiro back in the day.
Right.
I can't remember the name of a film, kind of a groundbreaking comedy film they made that Ken Shapiro made. Was in. Anyway, we digress.
Well, just to stay with that for just a second, the kind of like the third member of Steely Dan we had on the show a couple of weeks ago, Skunk Baxter, and he was fantastic.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, he is a fantastic guy, and I've been friendly with him since.
Sure.
Around the same time. Met him in the 70s through another guitar player, Elliot Randall, who played with him on Reelin' in the Years.
Did you know he worked for the Department of Defense?
Well, yeah, but I'm never sure how much you can divulge
right.
when it comes
I
to
know.
Jeff Baxter.
Right.
All I know is that I did it was a sort of a classified event in itself, a fundraiser for guys, Secret Service, not Secret Service. It was a CIA event.
Yeah.
And this was for families of guys who might get hurt in the line of duty. I was thrilled to kind of host a battle of the bands.
Oh, that's cool.
Did you know that a lot of spies have bands and are rock musicians?
No, I did not know that.
Turns out to be true. It turns out to be true. And somebody had the idea of, having a battle of the bands. And I got to be the MC. And Baxter, since the 70s, has been saying, you know, I work for the Department of Defense, you know, and I have, know, and we're sure. What is that court again, C7?
Right.
No one believed him. Right. But I get to this thing. It's in a non-disclosed location.
Sure.
You know, where this big party is going to take place, really, and a fundraiser and show. And there he is. First guy I get out of the car, there's Jeff Baxter. I said, it's true. He said, this is my event. I thought this up. And I said, I should have known.
Yeah, he was kind of like that with us. He said, you know, there are a lot of things I could tell you. But
he wouldn't tell.
Hey, we're talking to the legendary Paul Shaffer here in the National Defense. I just finished up the Martin Short memoir.
Oh, great.
And, you know, he talks extensively about you in that. And I guess you guys are best buddies. Your wives are friends. You go out and do that. What kind of things happen when you and Martin Short get together?
Marty and I go back even farther than with Chevy and Baxter.
Sure.
To Canada. You know, we're both originally from Canada.
Right.
1972, we were both in a show up there in Toronto. A rock musical from the 70s Godspell.
Yeah, I want to ask you. I want to ask you about that real quick. So Marty tells that story in his book, and if I remember correctly, you kind of showed up at Godspell not to audition, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, in Toronto, this was an open call. Now, anybody with the right age could come to audition for these New Yorkers,
right,
who were going to have a company of their Godspell show up in Toronto. Everybody was going, anybody in the kind of early 20s, Marty and Eugene Levy, Gilda Radner, they all got cast in it. And we're all still, you know, poor Gilda, we lost so many years ago. And we lost Marty's wife, by the way, about five, six years ago, maybe more. I had a number of friends auditioning for it. Two girls, by the way, in particular, both of them were great singers. And I used to make $20 for going to an audition with somebody and, you know, playing, accompanying them so they wouldn't have to use the house pianist. And I accompanied two people, and Stephen Schwartz, the composer, he's a composer of Wicked now, but Godspell was his first show. And he said, he heard the two girls sing and say, I want to talk to the piano player. And he hired me basically that day to conduct the show, and all of a sudden I was in show business, my first real theatrical job.
And you were the musical director. How old were you?
22.
Oh, wow.
Steve Schwartz himself, the composer, he was only about 24, 25 himself. Boy, was he ever poised.
Oh, my gosh.
And he knew exactly what he wanted.
That was pretty heady stuff for a 22-year-old, right?
I kind of couldn't believe it. I saw, you know, Eugene Levy a while ago, another great friend. We're still in touch. Now he's all over the place with his son and that show.
Whose
name we can't say. Well, no, it's Schitt's Creek because that's a family name.
That's right. That's a family.
Anyway, Eugene, we were reminiscing about that day and that final audition. We'll all always remember it, you know. We always talk about how Gilda Radner sang Zippity Doodah and was so cute. And Eugene says, you know, Marty and I celebrated afterwards. He says, you must have celebrated when you got. I said, well, not really. I was just shocked. I said, what just happened? I wasn't there auditioning. So I was just kind of, you know, whoa, this is life changing is all I was saying. And it sure was life changing.
We're talking to Paul Schaefer here in the National Defense. And for the people that only know you from the David Letterman show, it's what an amazing career you had way before you met David Letterman. I mean, Saturday Night Live, one of the original people on Saturday Night Live. And that was shortly after Godspell, right?
Well, yes. After I did Godspell for Stephen Schwartz, he said, I'm going to bring you to New York and play for me on Broadway, which he actually did in 74. And, he got me my first work visa to come into the country. I'm proud to be a citizen now.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, I needed a work visa, which he got for me and brought me into New York. And I was here in 1974. And then when it's 1975, I get a call from Howard Shore, a friend of mine, a musician in Canada, said, I'm coming with Lorne Michaels to do a new show called Saturday Night Live. And I'm going to be the musical director. This was Howard Shore. And he says, and I need a piano player. You're already there. And before I knew it, I was doing Saturday Night Live. They were all very heady and moving really fast. Yeah. So that was 1975. And I was now introduced to television and live television.
Right, right.
Pretty exciting. With the original, you know, cast, in not only Chevy, but
Gilda.
And Gilda, but Dan Aykroyd. Another Canadian.
Yeah.
But John Belushi.
What's up with Canada? I mean, Lorne Michaels is from Canada also. What's happening with
Canada? I get asked that a lot.
I'll bet.
What is it about Canada and the comics, the comic influence?
Mike Myers. I mean, you could go down the list, right?
Mike Myers and more recent. All I can say is that it's so cold up there that all we can do is you stay home and you watch American TV.
Right, right.
And I guess maybe you're watching it from a more objective viewpoint. I don't know exactly what it is. Or maybe that you cherish it even more.
Right, right.
Because it's like a lifeline to, you know, for me anyway, you know, musically there wasn't much nationally right. happening in Canada. Now it's different. At the time, though, you know, you had Gordon Lightfoot and the Guess Who, and that was about it as far as people who extended musically outside of Canada. Well, and it was the same for comics at that time. But now it's all different. Anyway, that's, you know, like the Beatles. I liken it to the Beatles, you know, hearing American rock and roll.
Right.
It was kind of the same for us in Canada, too. Just ordering the records, it's even more special when you got to order them or tune in,
see
a special American. If you can pick up, you know, once you get cable TV and start receiving American stations, you know, we up in Thunder Bay, we would get Marquette, Michigan television from there, and Superior,
sure,
and Duluth, Superior, Wisconsin, Minnesota.
Who was the big? The big famous disc jockey in Detroit was it Dick Purton?
I don't know. I heard of Robin Seymour.
Robin Seymour. You guys, in Canada itself, because I've been in radio my whole life. But I mean, Chum in Canada. CKLW, I think I remember. Those were huge stations. I mean,
Dave Marsden, is that? Or
yes.
You about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave Marsden, I haven't seen him in years, but when he first came on the scene when I was a kid, he was Dave Mickey. Screaming, you know, an early screaming and roll DJ.
Boss jock.
Influenced by the great Dick Biondi.
Sure. Right. Absolutely.
I used to be able to hear him. After dark, I could hear WLS.
Jeff Records Landecker.
Landecker, yeah. Way before his time was Biondi, though.
Yeah.
1962, probably, 61.
Right.
And then Art Roberts. Well, don't get me started on Chicago radio. That was a lifeline, too.
That was so good. We're talking to Paul Schaefer here on the National Defense. I got to point something out here because I just found this out. This year, you received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Wharton Institute for the Performing Arts in New Jersey. Congratulations. You're not classically trained. You can't be a part of that, Paul.
And a Lifetime Achievement Award. I'm not dead either, but, I am classically trained, just to clear it up. But nothing more than piano lessons. I mean, I didn't go to music school.
That's what I meant,
I didn't go to college. And then I ended up, you know, in New York, really competing with people that had degrees in music. I had taken piano lessons, and I could never sight read. I made up for it with ear training, and I really, I set up the David Letterman band such that we worked a lot by ear a lot, just like rock and rollers do, and you can work faster that way and more spontaneous.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know. You know, it was lovely of the Wharton School, which had a lovely evening in my honor, and I got to play with a lot of the kids.
That's cool.
That evening.
Oh man.
Yes.
But that was
a
special
evening. And I said
to
myself, man, if I had had training like this, you know, who knows where.
So tell me about the first time that you met David Letterman, about that first meeting.
Yes. First there was a call right after the fifth season of Saturday Night Live was over and all the original cast was leaving the show, and I too left the show at that point. And then I got a call, and David Letterman is doing a morning show live. And they actually offered me that job, and I had just finished SNL and said to myself, you know, how cool could it really be in the morning? And I passed on it.
Right, right.
And now David used to like to kid me on the air about it. He said, Paul, you couldn't get up that early. Isn't that true? Maybe that had something to do with it. Anyway, a couple of years later, you know, that show was still literally... certainly figuratively too hip for the room though in the morning,
yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, so I did too.
They called me later, 2 years later, whatever. Now he's coming back at night, even after Johnny Carson, 12:30. And I said, well, that's more like
that's
it.
More like, that's more like, that's my time frame.
And I came in, and by this point, come in and talk to him, see what happens, They weren't just offering it to me at that point.
Right.
So I came in, and it was David and his producer. Now, we hit it off right away. And he said he remembered some of the stuff I did on Saturday Night Live, specifically when Bill Murray would do his lounge singer.
Oh, the lounge singer. Yeah, that was great.
Whether it was Nick Winters or Nick Summers or Nick Spring.
Right.
And I would always be on keyboard. And David had an idea that and he was right, that I had something to do with the putting together those sketches with a team of about five other real clever writers. But Billy always knew what songs would be the funniest.
Really?
Star Wars. That was his idea. His idea, although we collaborated.
Oh, that was great.
So David mentioned that, and he had a producer who kept saying the same thing. Well, how much lead time do you want? That's all he said. With how much lead? I had no idea what he was talking about.
Right.
But they were saying interesting things like we can have a 4-piece band. Well, this is perfect for me because that's what I. No music school, but I sure knew how to do a 4-piece rock and roll band. That's what I'd done all my life. Yes, that sounds great. I found out later that it was because Johnny Carson controlled the time slot and said, you can have a show, you can have a band, but I have a big band. You can only have 4-piece. And that, well, really? perfect for me.
Right.
And their main question was, David's question, what kind of band would it be, the 4-piece? And I was influenced very greatly by a bar that I used to go to in Toronto when I was in college. They had live musicians in topless bars at that time. and that was the case with this one club called the Zanzibar on Yonge Street, Toronto. And where on Saturday afternoon, they had a very hip sitting in scene going on. But, ladies dancing with no tops. But on stage, cool. Guys slipping in behind the Hammond B3 and playing, R&B and jazz instrumentally. And I said that I'd have a band like that, R&B.
So you went,
I said, David, I'd do R&B instrumentally. Sorry.
You went to a topless bar for the music.
No, I can't complain, but I read Playboy for the articles.
Me too. Yeah.
That I did. But on Sunday afternoon, you got a little bit, you could sneak a peek over at the dances, but mainly you were there for the music. And I said, David, I'd do it like an R&B instrumental. And Dave said, I've always thought of myself as the white Wayne Cochran anyway, or the Wayne Cochran of comedy, something like that. Wayne Cochran, a little known regional R&B performer from Miami in
That's
the 60s,
funny.
Who was known as the white James Brown because he had cotton candy white hair up here. And who would have heard of him, but Letterman had.
Right.
That's when I said, I got to work for this guy.
That's so cool. And didn't he also tell you that during the show, you just say whatever you want? Say, even in the middle of an interview, if you have something to say, you say it.
He absolutely said that. How many bosses would say that?
Right.
And it may have been, I thought I'd overstepped or something. And I said, Dave, hey, I'm sorry. I jumped in on that line, and that's when he said, Paul, you can say anything you want at any time.
Wow.
He gave me so much confidence that I could improvise with him in a way that I couldn't on any other show or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was just
so supportive. And of course, him, the quickest of all of them. And I think all of the hosts would admit it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That he really showed how it should be done.
But the chemistry between you guys, the chemistry between everybody on the show, whether it was Biff or Chris, Chris Elliott, the great Chris Elliott. It's just
the guy under the seats.
I mean, just so many great things it was just groundbreaking from day one. And
it all went back to David, and he wanted. He didn't want anything fake. He didn't want to be a pretend. Let's pretend that Biff was late for work. And David said, no, we don't pretend that. He's the stage manager, he's on time, whatever it is. And with me, he kept encouraging me let's just have a conversation. I would like plan something that I would say, you know, that I would, and then I would say it. He would laugh, but afterwards say, let's just talk, you know, instead of knowing what we're going to say, you know, and he really wanted a loose, spontaneous thing.
And when it looked fakey on the show, it was meant to look fakey. Right. I mean, it was.
Well, yes. I mean, sometimes there would be a comedy sketch. Of course.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's different than, you know, let's pretend that, Joe Jonas is in the neighborhood and just drop by. No, he's never going to do that.
Right. Right.
We booked Joe Jonas on the show. Just call it what it is.
You know? Right.
Except, you know, Biff is in outer space. Well, then obviously, we start reading lines. And
sure.
And you can always tell if we had lines, you know, we were reading lines.
Oh, it was so.
It's not that we were trying to read them badly or anything, but you could tell that it was in a sketch end.
Have you, when is the last time you talked to Dave Letterman?
I talk to him regularly.
Oh, do you?
And by his, you know, he really, and I'm so flattered by that, he really wanted to keep our friendship going.
That's so good.
Afterwards, and has come through on that, and we speak all the time.
Yeah.
And see each other, not as much as we used to, but once in a while.
We're talking to Paul Schaefer here on the National Defense. I want to talk about some of these great collaborations that you've had musically. I mean, you've worked with just about everybody. We mentioned Donald Fagen, of course. You worked with a hero of mine, Jeff Healey. I mean, the late, great Jeff Healey. Oh, my gosh. Another Canadian, right?
Yes, yes. Now, I was interested that you... Did you do radio up by near the 49th parallel or something? You seem to know a lot about Canadian and acts.
I'm fast. I always wanted to work at Chum. That was always my goal. I never got up there. But
Chum, and then we had Chum FM. When I was in college, FM Progressive Radio was just coming in.
Right.
And that's when Dave Mickey, the screaming DJ, became Dave Marsden with a very cool FM voice.
Right.
Funny stuff.
You know,
what were we talking about, though?
We had Billy.
Mr. Jeff Healey.
Mr. Jeff Healey.
He was a blind guitarist.
Blind blues
And he
man.
Suffered from an affliction that I don't remember, but it eventually killed him.
He's
no longer with us.
But
he played guitar, self-taught, played in his own way, sitting down with the guitar tuned regularly, but on his lap, so that he was fingering it more like a steel guitar, except not with a bar, but from above, fingering it here.
Yeah.
Playing it here, but playing the blues. And he was a funky, soulful guitarist who, I don't know, maybe because we were both Canadians and I was doing Letterman by this point, but I would fly up a couple of times. I went up to do Canada, once to Montreal and another time to Toronto to record albums with him.
You got him on Letterman a couple of times, right?
Had him on a number of times, yeah. I'm in touch with his drummer and manager. His name was Tom Joseph, I think, who's making a documentary on him.
Cool.
And he was just, I saw him on YouTube the other day with Ronnie Hawkins, the Canadian rocker.
Yeah, sure.
We just lost. He tore down the house, and he was in a big movie called Roadhouse.
Oh, yeah.
That's where you can see Jeff Healey.
Absolutely. See him in action.
Internationally.
I saw him in St. Louis. I saw him perform in St. Louis. And you're right. He tore down the house. I mean, it was.
Yeah, yeah. And he was so seated, you know, always remained seated. But he could he could tear the roof off.
It was great. I knew that you had hosted the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. I didn't realize you've done it every year.
I don't know if they have hosts. I was the band leader.
Okay.
For 30 some years. Since the
inception, right?
And then sort of lead at the induction dinner. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then sort of leading the jam when there was a jam session.
Right.
I would lead a totally spontaneous jam session at the end.
That
would have
been kind of cool.
Ones. You can see a few of those on YouTube.
Oh, man, I'll bet
that. The early ones with just everybody on stage. I mean, an unforgettable one with Dylan and Jagger and George Harrison all on stage together.
Listen to what you're saying. They're on stage.
I know.
And you're part of that deal. Wow.
Not only that.
Wow.
Part of it, but some kind of cueing these guys who would take my cues. That used to surprise me. Play a solo, and a guy actually would. But yeah, I know. I was blessed to be around and play, interacted with so many of the important people from the rock and roll era, and those 30 years that David was on, and I was on with him. Well, it was a wonderful blessing.
And you know, the list goes on. I mean, Robert Plant, Peter Criss, Brian Wilson. I didn't realize that you did some stuff with Earl Scruggs.
Well, one thing.
Okay.
as a piano player, I used to know how to play Foggy Mountain Breakdown on the piano. It's a banjo song.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right.
And I just learned on the piano. And I used to play it occasionally. You know, if I needed a little country cue quickly on Letterman, I'd just go into it. And I think Earl Scruggs and his wife heard it. And when they were doing a tribute album to Earl and a big celebrity filled version of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, I got the call.
Wow.
From him personally.
Wow.
And his wife, both on the phone. Would you play on it? And thrilled to. I couldn't make it to Nashville, so they sent his son. Both of them died. Randy Scruggs was his son.
That's right.
Who produced that album. Yeah. And he came up and put me on it, you know, on an overdub. And then and I don't know why, but died a few years after that, too. He was lovely. Both of them, just lovely guys.
What, I mean, everything from, this is the one that I was floored by. You co-wrote It's Raining Men.
Yes, that was an unusual one, for sure.
If anybody is Paul Schaefer in any way connected to It's Raining Men? No, there's no way. That's crazy.
Starting to get around now. Well, it was in my early days, just breaking into the studio scene in New York, and I worked for a guy named Ron Dante, who was a producer, Barry Manilow's producer, in the early days, first five albums or so. And he used to produce other things and use me as an arranger. And an artist named Paul Jabara.
Sure.
Didn't make it as an artist. But we did a record with him. I arranged Ron producing. His record was called One Man Ain't Enough. So, you know, you can tell the direction this guy was going in.
Right, Paul Jabara.
A slightly flamboyant chap, but a genius and hilarious writer who called me up after we won an Oscar for writing Last Dance for Donna Summer.
Oh, sure.
And he said, you know, I got an idea for Donna, and I want you to write this one with me because I liked your arrangements. What do you think of the title? You know, It's Raining Men. I said, I'll be right over. And, you know, and I wrote it with him in one afternoon. He was all ready to go. He had the title and a lot of the concepts and a lot of the jokes from within it.
Sure.
Too, you know, and he just needed someone to put it to music, and that's what I got to do.
Oh,
so that's
gosh.
How I got in on that.
That's
on that song.
Incredible, and I'm sure that's part of your memoir, which that's next on my list. We'll be here for the rest of our lives, a swinging showbiz saga, and that came out a few years ago. I can't wait to get to that one. And
well, it's got all these weird stories.
Well, you got. I mean,
like
who can tell that?
Raining Men, and how my wife absolutely hated the song. And
oh, really?
That's another story.
All right,
she doesn't mind it now.
No, she likes it. Yeah. When the first
still
check,
paying royalties.
I was gonna say when the first check came in, I bet she started to like it.
She started to soften towards it. Yeah.
Paul, we do a regular thing here with our audience called "Got Your Six." It's six rapid fire questions for Paul Schaefer. You ready?
Okay. Okay.
Right. Last time you and your wife had a date night.
Well. I think it was probably, you know, some time ago, but we went to the Ridgefield Playhouse up here nearby where we live. And we do like to see, you know, I can get her out to see concerts and stuff.
Right, right.
Occasionally. So I can't quite even remember who we saw last up there, but we've seen a lot. They have a lot of great country performers and oldies performers at the Ridgefield Playhouse.
Did you go to dinner?
Yeah, we have dinner over there nearby. Yeah, like a real date night. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
We have two grown kids, you know.
Yeah.
Victoria, 29, doing dog rescue full-time in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's so
cool. Her own rescue organization called Pup Culture. And my son, cool. William, is 23. He's doing a post-bachelor program in Boston University right now.
Oh, man.
So we are empty nesters, and it's a little easier to get the wife out on a date.
Yeah. Do you have dogs?
We had dogs when the kids were growing up.
Yeah.
We don't anymore. We got to be free to run after them.
That's true. That's true.
California to see them, et cetera.
What kinds of things are hiding in David Letterman's beard?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think a lot of certain, I don't want to say aggression, but, you know, all I can say is that the more people complain about it and tell they wish he'd cut it, the longer it gets.
Of course. Of course. who was your favorite host in your time at SNL?
Oh, what an interesting question. Favorite host? I don't know. But I remember that Candace Bergen was a favorite of a lot of ours.
Oh, wow.
She was a hostess who would fit in with the cast and become a cast member.
Cool.
They were the most fun. And the criteria for hosts at that time was a little looser. Now it's, you know, really the hottest or whoever's got the hottest movie coming out.
Right.
Yeah. But then it would be an interesting person. What if Ron Nessen, the guy who was sort of I can't remember how to describe
White House,
him.
Like, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, he was a host one week. I don't know if you'll get him anymore.
Who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that is not?
Everybody's got a million.
Sure.
You know.
Dolly Parton's in there.
How about that? It moves on. Neil Sedaka. Should be in
Neil
there.
Sedaka is not. You know who I am?
An early rock pioneer and a pioneer in overdubbing, double tracking.
I had idea that he.
Studio techniques, hit after hit, associated with Elton John and everything he had going for him. But the hall moves on, you know, it's got to move on and acknowledge the newer people, et cetera. So that's one that I always regret.
I interviewed Don McLean. And brought up the fact that he was not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he said, you know, it doesn't matter to me. And then he took about 10 minutes to tell me why it didn't matter to him. So,
yeah,
that's another one. Do you honestly like poutine?
I barely know what it is. It's a Canadian dessert, isn't it?
I thought it was some kind of gravy and some other stuff in there.
Well, I never liked gravy on the fries, though. French fries and gravy.
Right.
Or French fries and vinegar, just vinegar on there. poutine, I think it was before my time.
Okay.
Or maybe after my time.
After you. Tell us one thing about Martin Short that nobody knows.
He sure is an open book. Everybody knows a lot about him.
That's
and everybody
true.
Talks. So much about how kind he is and what a loyal friend he is. Maybe his loyalty to some of his old friends that you wouldn't, you know, from Toronto, you wouldn't think he had stayed in touch with, but he's very loyal gentleman.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, listen, man, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on. It's been such a pleasure catching up with you.
Fun.
And thank you so much. It just means a lot. And thank you for all the entertainment over the years.
Nice of you to say, Randy, and, you know, it's a wonderful thing you're doing. Members of the armed forces and the veterans, you know, certainly have a soft spot in my heart. You know, one thing people don't know about David Letterman, he took me and a few other people overseas. First Christmas we were at war with Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
David and I were over there with Biff and a few other people, being with the troops. And then the next 2 years in Iraq, Christmas Eve.
Wow.
Amazing experiences, but I saw heroism and bravery over there that I never imagined.
Well, thank you for that, man. I really appreciate that. And tell Martin Short he needs to come on this program.
I will. I'll tell him what a good time I had.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
All right.
Have
all
a
right.
great day.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back here in the National Defense.